If you watch the Super Bowl, you know at least one commercial was really trying to make you think.
It can be hard to know when you need a new job. As a rule, if you hate going to work every day, it may be time. If you hate going to work and your coworkers don't respect you,
hey, dummy,
it may be time.
Career advice from last night's game. Are you going to take it? We're asking on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 2nd, Groundhog Day. John Hockenberry is on assignment. Catherine Lanfer is in for John. Welcome back and good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Adora. Good morning to you. This hour, we're going to kick off our special series, Power Trip. It's an in-depth look at the future of energy. And while Hawk's on the road talking to innovators, scientists, and investors, we're going to get started by talking with energy futurist Gary Golden, plus a trip inside your brain to see how you make choices. But first, let's get to these headlines.
President Obama's economic stimulus package faces the Senate this week. The president wants Republican support. Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin told Fox News he'll listen to GOP ideas.
We're very open to this. For instance, some of the Republicans have been saying to us, put more money in infrastructure, invest in the roads and highways and bridges, make sure that we create good-paying jobs here in America that we can see.
Any Republican Senate votes would be an improvement on the bill showing in the House, where not a single Republican voted for the stimulus package. Tax issues are troubling another Obama cabinet nominee. This time it's Health Secretary nominee Tom Daschle, whose payments fell short. Here's reaction from Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell on CBS.
It does raise some questions about the vetting process. This is now the second time that we've had a similar incident, first with the nominee for Secretary of the Treasury and now with Senator Daschle.
Daschle has amended his returns to pay back taxes and interest of tens of thousands of dollars.
The president is apparently set to tap Republican Senator Jed Gregg as Commerce Secretary. The New Hampshire already has a Democratic governor, spurring Democratic hopes they could pick up a Senate seat. But top Senate Republican Mitch McConnell, who we've just heard, says that Gregg assures him any senator picked would still vote with Republicans. Alaskans are bracing for a blast. Geologists predict that steaming Mount Redoubt volcano could soon erupt. The Air Force is moving planes out of the area to be safe. It last erupted some 20 years ago.
More than 20 police officers are dead in Afghanistan following a devastating blast. A suicide bomber infiltrated a police training center. Nearly 900 Afghan police died in militant attacks last year.
Violence is flaring back up in Gaza, and an Israeli airstrike hit the area in response to militant rocket and mortar attacks on Israel.
The Pittsburgh Steelers are champions again. They beat the Arizona Cardinals 27-23 last night to win a record sixth Super Bowl. So congratulations to them. The Dow opens at 8,000 this morning. It lost nearly 2% Friday. The S&P starts at 825. It dropped 2.25% on Friday. And as we said, John Hockenberry is on the West Coast this week working on our series Power Trip. He's looking at the future of energy. And we want to know, what's making it hard for you to save energy? What obstacles are in your town or in your home or at your workplace? What things could change that would make it easier to be more energy efficient? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. We begin today at a look ahead at what economists and politicians are going to be anticipating this week. The Obama administration will be grappling with the Senate over its stimulus bill. The Republicans will be looking to their new chairman, former Maryland Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, who happens to be the first African-American to head the party. And all over the world, leaders are returning home from the economic summit in Davos, Switzerland. Marcus Mabry, the international business editor of the New York Times, joins us in the studio this morning to talk about how all these issues are related. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
The Obama stimulus plan now passed the House at $819 billion last week, and already, just a few days in, it looks like it's going to be a different bill in the Senate. What are some of the issues the Senate is bringing up?
President Obama is very dedicated, it seems, to getting Republican support, at least some Republican support, for the Senate bill, which he did not get any, of course, not one single vote for the House bill. So he's basically going to be open to measures that the Republicans want that may include some greater bit of tax relief, as we call it now. We used to call them tax cuts. And it may include some further banking regulation as well.
As you mentioned, there was no support in the House, and many of the Republicans in the House were pushing tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. So when you say this revised bill may have more tax cuts, tax relief, what kind?
Probably aimed more at, you know, a little farther up at smaller businesses. I won't say farther up the economic ladder, which I was thinking about saying, but it'll be more aimed at small business rather than at rich individuals, which the Republicans actually are going to have to be careful about. The Republicans are walking a very tightrope here. They do not want to be seen as obstructionists.
Well, I was just going to say, what's the tightrope?
It's between being seen as obstructionists and being seen as actually being faithful to the GOP. Faithful, because right now they're at a point where you have a very popular president. Mm-hmm. You have a sense of urgency growing out there in the landscape about how bad this economy is. And if they're seen as the only obstacle between the president and any plan whatsoever, that could be a problem.
You know, one proposal that struck me, though, is the Republican won a $15,000 tax credit for all home buyers. I mean, one of the things they are trying to do is bring back the housing market, right?
Absolutely. Well, this is one of the big problems with this economy. The reason we don't really see a bottom going forward, and the fact that, you know, we've had millions of people lose jobs already, we expect it to be worse this year than it was last year. The reason we don't see an improvement or a bottom is because we don't see what is going to bring back stability to the housing market. And without those valuations coming back, you don't see a bottom to the worsening of the economy. So something's got to be done. The Democrats have talked about that as well, a direct plan to help homeowners, particularly those who are close to foreclosures. The Republicans don't want to help those who are close to foreclosures, but more those who are actually all paid up.
And in terms of tax relief, we should also add the alternative minimum tax. There's discussion about how to handle that.
Well, there's going to have to be, you know, the Bush administration at the end of its term was actually doing a pretty good job of trying to help increasingly middle class people who were caught by the alternative minimum tax. It was originally meant as a way to keep the very rich from paying no taxes whatsoever. It was not indexed for inflation. So what we have is just regular old middle class families who are certainly not rich being caught in it more and more each year. So there will definitely be a plan to give them some relief from the AMT.
And you talked about the Republican leadership. Big news. They have a new chairman. That's Michael Steele. He's a former attorney general and a different face. Now the Democrats have their African-American at the helm, and now the Republican Party has their African-American at the helm.
Well, this is rather extraordinary. You know, in the space of these few months here, after more than 230 years of American government, we now have black men leading both political parties. It is hard to believe, and if you had predicted it just 2 years ago, most people would have said that neither of those guys would have been leading their parties this time out. So it's rather extraordinary. It's going to be interesting to see how Michael Steele, who is a fairly moderate former lieutenant governor of Maryland, failed in his Senate bid, how he does in this role where, again, he's going to have to be leading this party as it comes back out of the wilderness.
He's not a party line guy. I mean, here is a man who was very critical of the Bush administration when it came to its response to Katrina, to some aspects of the Iraq War.
It's going to be interesting to see. You know, at one point when he finally, after on the sixth vote, actually at the Republican National Committee, finally got the nod and got the job as chairman, he actually said, you know, he's going to be a bulldozer, stand out of our way, we're coming back. And he's referring to the party. I'm not sure who he was referring to as far as who he's going to bulldoze over, whether he's talking about the party's conservative base and Rush Limbaugh, or if he's talking about the Democrats.
Well, that was going to be my question, because there was all that chatter last week about Rush Limbaugh actually being the sort of nominal head of the party. And yet at the same time, you have a party that in the last election had its worst showing among minorities in, what, 150 years? I mean, that goes back a ways.
It's true. It's hard to believe the Republicans could have been worse off. The interesting thing is going to be is this election of Steele does it really have the support, though, that stems down to some, at least some part of the Republican grassroots?
But it's got to help that he is on Fox News, that he's a celebrity there, that, you know, Adore and I were talking earlier. He's charismatic.
He's very charismatic, and he's an incredibly smart kind of spinner. You know, as we've seen some other, you know, I've written a book about Condi Rice, some other black Republicans who are very smart and very, you know, telegenic and great spinners of the news, which is what you have to be in this job as party chair. He is going to be, I think, you know, better than Rice was, because he kind of feels less kind of, she can sometimes feel very smart, but sometimes very distant and cold. He comes across as a warm, caring individual. It's going to be interesting to see, though, how he tries to square that with the Republican base. I'm just not sure what the base is, especially the conservative evangelical base, in support of him will be.
On the other hand, though, there are other moderates. I'm thinking of Governor Pawlenty in Minnesota, who are seeing this as their chance to remake, as they call it, the party of Walmart, instead of the party that as it was seen previously.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I think these governors are going to be the crucial partners for Steele, either the partners or the competitors, whether it's Pawlenty or whether it's Bobby Jindal, who a lot of people have talked about in Louisiana, or whether it's, frankly, Sarah Palin from Alaska, who also used that Walmart line.
Yeah,
can't forget about her. She'll be out there.
Okay.
So what do you think it says that the Republican Party put an African-American at the helm? Is it a sign that true reform is coming? Do you think it was a reactionary decision based on Barack Obama becoming president?
I'm going to take the easy way out here, because if I was a columnist, I'd probably speak more bluntly, but I'm going to take the easy way out here and say time will tell.
What
the party actually does.
Is it because it's so early?
What the party actually does, I think, as far as its policies, will really show us whether this is a new Republican Party, which is aiming for a new kind of centrist road, or whether it's a party that actually is divided against itself, and whether this was more of a token appointment. Again, you know, I don't think you can know at this point.
I'm going to let you off the hook, because we need to talk about the International Economic Summit at Davos. Many described it as almost an irrelevant summit, where they spent days, 2,000 business and political leaders spent days talking about all of the problems of the world financial markets. But do you think there was something we learned that's relevant to all of the problems that the world is facing?
Well, a few things came out of it. Usually, not a whole lot of substance comes out of Davos. It's kind of a great kind of place for deals to happen and arrangements to happen, whether between businesses or between governments and public-private partnerships. That's what it's been in the past. But, you know, Bono and Bill Clinton can sit down and get something going.
It's been very glitzy,
exactly.
Lots of parties.
This time, what's interesting was who wasn't there.
Right.
Lots of the big leaders from business were not there. The people who are most important, people who you wanted to talk to, were not the people who were former masters of the universe, but the people who were, in fact, the government leaders, because governments are running an awful lot of markets, an awful lot of economies and businesses.
And there was also some very strident criticism of the United States in terms of, you know, there was a big jockeying game about who's to blame for the crisis in global capitalism.
And that's very interesting. That's going to be the question we have to watch. We're going to have to watch. There were some comments made by the Chinese leadership over the weekend.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to watch what happens as far as the value of the dollar, what happens as far as this economy long-term, what the world thinks about us long-term as we spend our way. And on the right and left, economists say we have to spend our way back to prosperity.
You mentioned the Chinese, and there's been some question and debate and much written about whether or not they're going to continue to buy U.S. debt.
That's exactly the question. Right now, they have massive reserves. The question is going to be, do they continue to do it? Jinwen Bao, who was speaking in London over the weekend, said China's going to be careful and make sure that its reserves are always in China's interest, whatever is in its currency reserves. Well, that's what any good central banker should say anyway. That's what you expect. So I'm not surprised by that. But we'll see how the markets move in relation to the dollar and to treasuries this week.
Well, we'll be watching. Marcus Mabry, thank you.
Thank you.
Marcus Mabry is the international business editor of the New York Times and a good friend of ours here at The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Here's a question for you. What obstacles are keeping you from becoming energy efficient? Do you have to drive to work because bike paths are non-existent? Is there recycling pickup, or do you have to haul your own things to a special center? We want to hear your story at 877-8-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Obstacles to fuel efficient energy efficiency. And that brings us to this. That's The Takeaway on a power trip. Ooh. All week. John Hockenberry's on the road talking to innovators, scientists, and investors. And he's going to be moving from an algae farm in Washington State to Silicon Valley to a company starting up there. And he'll be visiting the places and people that stand to change everything from your monthly electricity bill to what you pump into your car. To launch our series, energy expert Gary Golden joins us in the studio. Gary is the editor of the blog, The Energy Roadmap. Good morning, Gary. And some people call you a futurist. Would that be right?
Correct.
What is that?
Well, futurists help people and organizations understand long-term disruptive change. So I actually have a graduate degree in future studies from the University of Houston, and it teaches professional futurists to work with organizations.
And so you're going to talk about new technologies and changes that you think are needed for America to work towards cleaner energy. Let's start with a myth.
Sure.
Is the goal to become, say, coal-free?
That's a good question. It depends on who you ask. Hmm. So coal is definitely not the future of energy, but it certainly has a future.
So, well, what about all the preaching that we get, though, that, you know, coal is dirty and we have to step away from it completely?
It would be a very difficult transition to make. So coal is the primary, over 50% of our energy to produce electricity comes from coal. So to make a transition in which none of the power generation comes from coal would be a multi-decade-long transition.
And you say there are four things, then, mm-hmm. specific things that the U.S. Mm-hmm. can do. First up, redesign the energy grid. That sounds like a tall order.
Correct.
Explain.
So the vision that is being promoted by the government and the private sector is one of a smart grid. So today we have a grid, an electrical grid, that is a one-way stream of energy. And if you cut that stream at any point, you don't have power on the user side. So the smart grid integrates software to make things just more manageable, sensors to kind of close the communication feedback loop, and then storage at the local level to avoid any disruption to the power.
Like the blackout that we suffered on the East Coast several years ago.
Correct. And then also for hospitals and computer farms and offices that require electricity.
And how do you begin that process? And is it on the agenda?
It is on the agenda. So the biggest change that needs to happen is regulatory reform that governs how utilities profit from what they do.
Step two, renewable energy alternatives, solar, algae, and wind.
Sure. So the problem with renewable energy is that there's no way to store it effectively. So utilities are very reluctant to put on a new source of energy unless they can have absolute reliability. And until we come up with a utility scale size storage solution for solar and wind, it's unlikely that it's going to really grow as a market share.
Does the science exist to store it?
It does, but it continues to advance every year. So, you know, at the current energy storage technology is based on batteries. And the next generation of energy storage technologies will include hydrogen fuel cells and capacitors.
So the money needs to be invested to develop capability.
Definitely. So there's still a lot of opportunity left in investing in basic science.
Number three, you talk about making products energy efficient, and along with that would be encouraging consumers to use those energy efficient products.
Correct. So the lowest hanging fruit in this new energy economy is efficiency. So there's a saying in the energy industry that the cheapest power plant is the one that you don't have to build. So how can we, you know, this goes from changing light bulbs to having smart thermostats and smart meters. And this is where companies like IBM and General Electric and Honeywell are getting involved in government efforts.
So whose responsibility is that then? Is it the responsibility of the government to create those incentives for private industry, or should private industry be taking a lead in order to cut their own costs?
It's a mixture. So the government is definitely needed to, again, provide the regulatory framework that enables these type of efficiency solutions. But the private sector has opportunities to just deliver solutions over the retail shelf.
And you talk about a big picture issue. Reducing poverty is a way to reduce energy consumption.
Sure.
Explain that to us.
So if you look globally, not just within the United States, the poorer you are in the world, the worse you're going to be in terms of the type of energy that you use. So you're going to use the lowest form of energy, lowest cost form of energy. So as you move up that economic scale, your energy consumption patterns become more efficient and more clean.
When you take a look at these issues that you've outlined, the four we've just mentioned, what kind of timeline do you think is reasonable for us to expect movement on any of these, from storing energy to creating more energy efficient products?
I think it's important to focus on the transition, that this is going to take several decades. But over the next 10 years, I think that we're going to see significant progress in smart grid technology. And then also the early stages of algae and cleaner forms of coal.
Gary Golden, we appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you.
Gary Golden is the editor of the blog, The Energy Roadmap, and he'll be blogging today on our website, thetakeaway.org, answering any of your questions about the new energy infrastructure, proposals, ideas, or debates. And this is the first installment in the energy series that we'll be doing at The Takeaway called Power Trip. John Hockenberry is on the road, and he'll be joining us with many stories from the West Coast tomorrow. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thank you very much. Is that John playing, do you think, in the background?
Could be.
28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. A sensational catch by MVP Santonio Holmes in the final seconds gave the Pittsburgh Steelers a 27-23 win over the Arizona Cardinals in Super Bowl 43. It happened right after Kurt Warner hit Larry Fitzgerald for a 65-yard touchdown pass, giving Arizona their first lead. Warner has set the record for most passing yards in Super Bowl history. It's going to be a big week for President Obama's stimulus plan as it heads to the Senate for debate. As senators hash out the right mix of tax cuts and infrastructure spending, the president stands ready, according to his aides, to sweet talk or arm twist as needed.
I've done extraordinary outreach, I think, to Republicans because they have some good ideas, and I want to make sure that those ideas are incorporated.
That's President Obama speaking on NBC. The president is also keeping much of his schedule free to be able to respond quickly as the discussion progresses. And the Senate is poised to confirm Eric Holder as the nation's first African-American attorney general today. And there will be 3 hours of scheduled debate first. That's a look at some stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Monday, February 2nd. We're thinking about energy efficiency this morning. We're wondering, are there things you just won't give up to be energy efficient? Are you feeling like everyone's preaching to you about saving energy, about being more efficient? Or is it just too expensive to make some of the changes that would make your home perhaps more fuel efficient, or perhaps your car more fuel efficient, or your workplace more energy efficient? We want to hear what your thought is on this. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Hey, Adora, when it comes to making decisions, it often seems like there are two kinds of people. And the one kind, you've already seen him. He's the guy in the coffee shop who's agonizing over whether his half-calf latte needs whipped cream or not. We've all been there. And then there are those people capable of a split-second decision that can save lives.
Please welcome the crew of U.S. Airways Flight 1549, who helped safely rescue 150 passengers on New York's Hudson River.
Of course, that was the crew, as they said, of U.S. Airways Flight 1549, receiving praise last night at the Super Bowl for their quick thinking in a crisis. Quick thinking that saved the lives of more than 100 passengers when their plane made that emergency landing in the Hudson River. So which one are you, split-second decider or agonizer? If you're thinking that maybe you make both kinds of decisions, well, that's a good thing. We're here with neuroscientist Jonah Lehrer. He's the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist, and he has a new book out called How We Decide. Hey, welcome back to the show, Jonah.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to know what drew you to this topic.
It was my own pathological indecision in the supermarket, I'm afraid. I'm the guy ahead of you at the coffee store who can't decide if it's the Venti or the, you know, the other one.
Oh, man.
I'm the guy who would spend 10 minutes in the cereal aisle choosing between Honey Nut Cheerios or Apple Cinnamon Cheerios. So it was that very basic everyday failing that first got me interested in the subject.
What did we know about decision making that we didn't know before?
Well, I think for the first time we can break open the black box, as they say, and actually see inside the mind. So we're not just theorizing about how the mind works from the outside. We can actually look inside and see the different brain areas that are active when you're, say, choosing which coffee to get.
Okay, so let's say when you're in that cereal aisle and you can't figure out if you want Honey Nut Cheerios or Apple Cinnamon Cheerios, what part of your brain is blinking then?
Well, the problem is something scientists call paralysis by analysis.
That doesn't sound so scientific, Jonah. That sounds like common sense.
It also sounds pretty highfalutin for a cereal decision. Yeah.
Well, that's what happens to me, I'm afraid. And this idea first came from the work of someone named Antonio Damasio, who he studied patients who, because of a traumatic brain injury, had lost the ability to experience emotion. So I think the old idea of human nature was that if you don't experience emotion, you should be perfectly rational. You should be some uber-rational creature who always chooses the right box of cereal in the morning. Instead, what he found was that these people became like me, pathologically indecisive, that they would spend 5 hours choosing to use a blue pen or a black pen, or spend all day trying to figure out where to eat lunch. So this, for the first time, got scientists interested in the importance of our emotions in terms of making decisions, because these people had lost the ability to experience emotions, and that didn't leave them with, you know, the gift of pure rationality. Instead, it literally was a disease. It was a disease of decision making.
You know, whenever I hear any kind of discussion about making decisions, you can't help but think of Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, which, you know, sort of gave us all permission to go with our gut. How would you fine tune his thesis?
Well, my book is definitely, you know, in part a celebration of gut instinct and a celebration of the emotional brain, but it's really about how the brain is like a Swiss Army knife. Your brain is stuffed full of different mental tools, and the key is knowing when to use these different tools. So in a sense, how we think should depend on what we're thinking about, but there are absolutely decisions that benefit from the emotional brain, and there are absolutely decisions that benefit from deliberate rational thought.
So what does it say if you're one of those people who makes very quick decisions versus one of those people who generally always is very indecisive?
Well, that would tend to suggest that you're more comfortable trusting your emotional brain if you rely on those gut decisions. And the emotional brain is a generic term that refers to this whole network of different brain areas, from the amygdala, which is largely responsible for the feeling of fear, to the insula. Nucleus accumbens. So all these different brain areas, we refer to them as the emotional brain.
I love the
phrase. These are brain areas we share with, mm-hmm. you know, rats, monkeys. These are, you know, very primitive, well-refined. And the good news is they've been perfected by evolution, so to speak. They don't make, you know, lots of generic mistakes, unlike the prefrontal cortex, which is a relatively new invention. So as I compared in the book. That's like Windows Vista. It's a software operating system that's been rushed to market. And so the end result is it's full of lots of bugs. So we have to be careful when we, you know, think.
Okay, here is the part that I love. You say that making the wrong decision, in other words, messing up, can be a good thing.
Absolutely. When you look at how our brain cells learn, and I'm talking in particular about dopamine brain cells, which are a crucial component of learning in the brain, they learn best by studying what they got wrong. So in a sense, they learn how to do right by studying past errors, studying past mistakes. And I think one thing I found, I talked to a bunch of experts from a soap opera director to a pro quarterback to a, you know, the world's best backgammon player, and what they all have in common is this obsession with studying their mistakes. So the soap opera director, he got home from a day's work, he puts in the tape, and he forces himself to find 30 mistakes in that day's tape. Most of these mistakes are so minor, no one else even notices. But he forces himself to make a list of all these past errors.
Okay, it sounds...
And that turns out to be a crucial component of learning.
It sounds like what you're saying is introspection is good.
Yes, in that case, introspection is very good. And I think one of the big takeaways... use the word of the hour in my
yeah.
book.
We like is, that. Okay, Jonah.
Is metacognition, is thinking about thinking.
Okay, that's Jonah Lehrer. He is the author of a new book, How We Decide.
Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got some headlines for us.
And the time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Barack Obama is expected to announce New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg as his pick for Commerce Secretary today. Gregg has confirmed that he's in the running, but is assuring fellow Republicans that even if he gets the post, his valuable Senate seat will go to another Republican. On another,
I don't understand that. How does he know that?
That's because New Hampshire's Governor John Lynch is a Democrat, and he will have sole discretion in choosing
right.
a replacement. But he's been known for his independent thinking, and according to his advisors, is likely to pick another Republican for the seat.
Uh-huh.
But who knows?
Right.
We could ask Pox Attorney Phil.
How did I know that was coming?
He knows everything. He knew that the Pittsburgh Steelers were going to win.
I think we need to let go of our dislike for the...
I love fat rodents. Meanwhile, as we continue with some other news, Eric Holder is expected to be confirmed today as the nation's first African-American Attorney General. And the president's pick for Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Daschle, has sent a letter to Senate leaders apologizing for recent revelations that he failed to pay more than $100,000 in taxes owed for a car and driver that was provided to him after he left the Senate. He's expected to meet with members of the Senate Finance Committee behind closed doors tonight. And a Japanese volcano, Mount Asama, erupted today, sending up huge plumes of smoke and gas, and fine powdery ashes also falling over parts of Tokyo. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Hockenberry is on the West Coast this week, and he's working on our series, Power Trip. It's an in-depth look at the future of energy. And we want to know, what questions do you have about energy sources? What parts of the new infrastructure don't you understand? And are you finding it easy to save energy, or are you frustrated? We want to hear your story at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And to launch our series, today with us is energy expert Gary Golden. He is the editor of the blog, The Energy Roadmap. So good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning.
The world is going to double its energy consumption by 2030. What is that going to mean in terms of the urgency of renewable energy?
It means that we have to begin quickly. We must begin now. So, again, we need to recognize that the transition is going to take several decades to unfold. So in order to meet those demands of providing new, cleaner sources of energy, we need to start building today.
We hear things like that all the time, renewable energy. But Gary, what can we do in our everyday lives, and how do we not get overwhelmed by the fact that we need to do something?
Well, I think there is something to be said about recognizing what can be done by a consumer versus what can be done by the industry or industries and the government. And I think that if we're looking for the greatest return on our investment, it's going to come at changing how industries and large sectors operate.
Give us an example.
Well, I think changing the automobile industry is a fantastic example. The electrification of the automobile industry is something that is driven both by consumer demand, but also from government policies.
So me as a consumer can help the auto industry be more efficient if I buy more fuel-efficient cars.
Correct.
And then the role of the government would be in the instance of the automotive industry.
Correct. And they would, you know, enable the transition, so they would provide funding for energy storage and, you know, provide the infrastructure to make that transition.
I can't get over the rate of change that we are supposed to expect. I mean, exponentially, it seems like things have been the same in terms of our energy consumption for decades and decades and decades. And now, flip the switch, we're supposed to change fast.
Correct. So we're going to add 3 billion more people to the planet over the next several decades. So each individual is going to consume energy. So we're really chasing the population curve at this point.
But in terms of just my everyday life, because I get stuck on that sometimes, what can I do? It's light bulbs, right? I could be more efficient in my home.
Isn't it like what your dad used to say when you were a kid? Turn that light off.
Turn that light off. Use less water. I mean, what are the measurable things that may not change the world but certainly will help?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, I think the best thing would be to raise a scientist, to raise a technologist, someone that can actually build in system-wide change. There is a limitation to what consumers can do in terms of improving their energy consumption. There's room to improve, but there are limits as well.
And so government and private industry are really going to have to step up to the plate. Gary Golden, thank you.
Thank you.
Gary Golden is the editor of the blog, The Energy Roadmap, and he's going to be answering your questions all day and all week on thetakeaway.org. What kinds of energy are out there? What kinds of things can you do in your community? What kinds of things should government and private industry be doing to make our country more fuel efficient? Thetakeaway.org, your questions to Gary Golden, an energy expert.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 2nd, and Femi Okeh has the latest headlines for us.
Hello there. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. Just received in the consumer spending figures, and consumer spending falls for the record six straight months as worried households boost their savings. The Senate will debate President Obama's economic stimulus package this week. The House-approved bill must now pass the Senate. The president hopes for more Republican support than in the House. Not a single House Republican voted for the plan. Both President Obama and Democratic Senate leaders signal that they're willing to make some changes to get GOP votes. Alaska is bracing for a volcanic eruption. Steam is shooting out of Mount Redoubt, and geologists say that it could blow. The Air Force is taking the warning seriously. Pilots moved several planes away from the area. The volcano last erupted 20 years ago. Both sides in Gaza are again straining the ceasefire there. Today, Israel launched an airstrike. The bombing was in response to militant rocket and mortar fire over the weekend. Israel's defense minister says it does not intend another broad operation in Gaza. More than 20 police officers are dead in Afghanistan. A suicide bomber disguised as a cop hit a training center there today. A Taliban-affiliated group claims responsibility. And these are especially dangerous times for Afghan police officers. Nearly 900 died in militant attacks last year. And finally, the weather.
And as he looked, a bright sky above me showed my shadow beside me. So six more weeks of winter it will be. Oh, woe is us.
Oh, woe is me.
Whoa.
That is your forecast for today.
Can't you hear me crying?
Let's look at some headlines making news for you this morning.
All right. Millions of Iraqis went to the polls this weekend, Adore, in the first provincial election since 2005. One major difference, Sunnis sat out that last election, but this time they joined in at the polls. Presumably, it made a big difference. To find out, we're going to talk to Anthony Shadid. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, and he joins us now from Baghdad. Hey, thanks for joining us, Anthony. Let's get right into it with the fact that the Sunnis did sit in, that they actually voted this time around. What kind of difference are we going to see?
Yeah, I think it's going to make a dramatic difference, particularly in the predominantly Sunni areas that are north of Baghdad and west of Baghdad. I think what we're going to end up in some ways with is a more fractured landscape in some respects. Like you pointed out, in 2005, most Sunnis boycotted. That left power in the hands of one religious party that was Sunni, but that a lot of people feel didn't represent the community all that well. I think this time we're going to see ex-Ba'athists, we're going to see tribal forces, we're going to see a much more diverse landscape in some respects.
Now, talk about who was running in these elections.
Well, you can look at the elections from a lot of different perspectives. Like you pointed out, it's a provincial election. So in some ways, there was a different election in almost every region of the country. In the South, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, once an unpopular figure, but now someone who has gained a lot of support for, you know, rightly or wrongly being credited with restoring some order in Iraq. He was running against another religious party in southern Iraq, and it seems that just from early results right now, he seems to have done quite well, bolstering his own stature and bolstering the stature of his party. This is going to be important as we look toward parliamentary elections toward the end of the year. In other regions of the country, we saw secular parties going against religious parties. Secular parties seem to have done well, again, in these initial results. And I think this is a sign of disenchantment and some frustration with the administration of these provincial councils the past 4 years. A lot of people, you hear often in the streets, people denouncing or criticizing religious parties for their lack of performance. Again, all this stuff is very tentative and still early. We're probably not going to know final results till the end of the month.
Anthony, you mentioned it. The elections were a test of many things, and including would be a test of security. Now, the Iraqi security forces handled much of the setup for nearly 8 million people who apparently went to the polls. How do you think they did, considering there was little reported violence?
You know, even the campaign itself, I don't want to minimize what happened during the campaign. 5 candidates were assassinated. There were bombings here. But I think even during the campaign itself, violence was not anywhere near a factor as it was in 2005. And you're exactly right. What we saw in the streets of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities was a huge security clampdown. Traffic was banned from streets. There was a curfew the night before. And, you know, from what we can see at this point, it was almost entirely successful. There was hardly any violence on election day. I think what's going to be important as we look forward, especially for the Obama administration, is that this is going to be seen as a sign that maybe security forces are able to stand on their own a little more. That's going to be a debate, and I think people are going to use this maybe in ways, rightly and wrongly, to promote or to push for a U.S. withdrawal. I think this is going to be a turning point in some ways, though. I think this is going to be a sign that security in eyes of some people in the administration is good enough for the Americans to begin withdrawing in substantial numbers.
Do you think it's also a sign that perhaps Iraqis are accepting political means as a way of dealing with differences, or is that going too far?
You know, that's a great question. I think that's another, again, when we talk about what this election is going to be remembered for, I think that's going to be one of the issues that people look at. It's in some provinces, it's not all that important. But if you look at provinces like Diyala, which is a mixed Sunni-Shiite province north of Baghdad, or the Nineveh province, which, again, is in northern Iraq, and you've got a Kurdish-Arab fault line. You know, if Kurds in Nineveh, for instance, can surrender power to Arabs through elections, if Shiites in Diyala can surrender power to Sunnis through elections, I think we're going to see that the simple act of voting has become a means to transfer power, and that's something remarkable, and it may become institutionalized. That's easier said than done.
Right.
And I think we're going to have to, you know, people are going to look very closely in the next few weeks of how much violence happens in those provinces that are quite violent still, how many protests about the results, how much fighting between parties and factions. I think it's going to be a real test of whether elections are becoming institutionalized here in some respects, and institutionalized as a means of transferring power from community to community.
Well, talk about turnout then. 51% across the country, and even less in Baghdad. I think it was something like 40%. What does that say about how institutionalized this is getting?
I have to say I was surprised by those numbers, and I think, you know, we're polling that turnout might be even bigger than in 2005, and indeed it probably should have been, because Sunni Arabs were participating in far greater numbers than they did 4 years ago. But I think you're right to point out that lower turnout in Baghdad, surprisingly in Anbar, which is a predominantly Sunni province, it was low, and in the south, in the predominantly Shiite south, it was lower than we saw in 2005. And I think this can be read a lot of ways. One, the security clampdown may have made it difficult for people to get to the polls. There have been complaints that people couldn't find their polling station. They didn't know where to cast their ballot. But I think it also probably suggests there's a pretty substantial current of discontent and frustration and disenchantment with the way politics have gone for the past 4 years. You hear this all the time when you're talking to people, you know, around the country, that these provincial councils delivered us nothing. And I think just the simple act of not voting was in some ways a protest of how administration has happened the past 4 years. And it may also measure a certain loss of faith in the entire process, the entire election process itself.
All right. Anthony Shadid, we're going to have to let you go. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony Shadid, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post.
John Hockenberry is on the West Coast this week working on our series, Power Trip. And we're taking a look here at The Takeaway at the future of energy and some of the innovations that are happening. And so that triggered the question for you. What's making it hard for you to save energy? Or are you going to great lengths to save energy? What obstacles are in place in your own town, perhaps your own home? What do you think would make it easier to adopt more energy efficient habits? And we've been getting emails about how you save energy.
Okay. Including one person who said, listen, if you want a quick way to figure out what to do, do an energy audit. Or better yet, just figure out how to get rid of the cold drafts.
And John Best from New Jersey came up with 9 things he says he's doing to save energy, including keeping his home 5 degrees colder. And he writes that he and his wife tried to get a solar cell for his house, but that would have cost $28,000. So
wow.
Sometimes it's the cost just simply too much. Is it the recycling coming to you, or do you have to bring all of your recycled goods to a dumpster of some sort?
That stops a lot of people, in fact.
So give us a call and tell us what some of your obstacles or perhaps successes are. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And, well, here we are, as always. We have a thought for you on what the takeaway of the day is.
It's going to be interesting to watch what happens as far as the value of the dollar, what happens as far as this economy long term, what the world thinks about us long term as we spend our way. And on the right and left, economists say we have to spend our way back to prosperity.
That's Marcus Mayberry, international business editor of the New York Times, talking about the stimulus package and whether or not there's agreement on spending our way back to prosperity. And thanks to Gary Golden, editor of the blog The Energy Roadmap, for being with us this hour. And thanks to you, Catherine Lanfer, who's in for John Hockenberry as he reports from the West Coast. So thank you.
Hey, it's always great to be here, Adora.
And John will be with us from tomorrow from Seattle. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
In the old days, talking about your salary was, well, taboo.
I don't make this much.
Come on, be for real, Mike.
I don't. I'll prove it to you. There is pay stub.
Are you serious? You're earning this?
Plus perks, yes.
Mike, this is barely more than I make. You've been here 10 years, dog.
That's from The Office. But all signs point to the fact that more people are having open discussions about how much they make and how much their colleagues make. Are you sure you want to know? We do. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's February 2nd, Monday, and John is on the road talking to innovators, scientists, and investors. Because at The Takeaway, we're doing a series called Power Trip, and we're taking a look at the future of energy, and we'll hear from John tomorrow. But today, Catherine Lanfer is in for him. Good morning, Catherine, and welcome back.
Thank you, Adora. This hour, along with your salaries, we're looking at the president's stimulus package, the state of welfare as we know it, the 30th anniversary of the revolution in Iran, and the ads from last night's Super Bowl. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Fresh economic data is out just this hour. Consumer spending dropped for a record sixth straight month. Personal income also dropped. The next fight for President Obama's stimulus package starts this week with a Senate debate. The president wants Republican support and tells NBC he's open to GOP suggestions.
I've done extraordinary outreach, I think, to Republicans because they have some good ideas, and I want to make sure that those ideas are incorporated.
Any Republican Senate votes would be an improvement on the bill showing in the House, where not a single Republican voted for the stimulus package.
The Senate is poised to confirm Eric Holder as Attorney General today. He got some grief over his role in Clinton-era pardons, but he appears on track to get some Republican support. It's ready to blow. Geologists predict that Alaska's Mount Redoubt volcano could soon erupt. It's now steaming hot, so residents are preparing for the worst. Here's emergency management official Genevieve Moritz on KTVA-TV.
We plan for all scenarios and all situations, and we have response plans for those that we'll put in place quickly.
The Air Force is moving planes out of the area to be safe. More than 20 police officers are dead in Afghanistan following a devastating blast. A suicide bomber infiltrated a police training center. Nearly 900 Afghan police died in militant attacks last year. And the Pittsburgh Steelers are champions again. They beat the Arizona Cardinals last night to win a record sixth Super Bowl.
The Dow opens at 8,000 this morning. It lost nearly 2% Friday. The S&P starts at 825. It dropped 2.25% on Friday. And as we mentioned, John Hockenberry is working on the West Coast. He's working on what we're calling our Power Trip series. It's an in-depth look at the future of energy. And we're wondering, would you be more energy efficient, perhaps, if they were bike paths and you could ride your bike to work and not drive? What obstacles are you facing in your life, right, Catherine, that make it difficult for you to conserve energy, fuel, etc.?
Exactly.
We want to hear your stories at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Our 8778-MYTAKE line is having technical difficulties, so send us an email.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. With unemployment numbers reaching record highs in many states, some expected the welfare numbers to also rise. But according to an investigation by our partners at the New York Times, welfare is not keeping pace. In fact, 18 states cut their welfare rolls last year, and nationally, the number of people receiving cash assistance remained at or near 40-year lows. The Times reporter on the story is Jason DeParle, who joins us from Washington. He's also the author of The American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. Welcome and good morning, Jason. Let's talk big picture first. In your story, you describe a shifting trend for welfare in 18 states. What do you attribute this to?
In 18 states, there are fewer people getting welfare. Some states have put into place procedures in the last couple of years that make it harder to get welfare.
Let's take Michigan for an example. You lay that out in your story. Tell us how they're handling things.
There was a law passed in 2006 that threatened states with new financial penalties if they didn't make further progress in cutting their welfare rolls or putting more of the people on their rolls into work programs. Michigan responded with a process that makes people spend a month looking for a job before they can come on the rolls. That means they have to make daily attendance at a job search program before they can come on and get cash assistance. So that sounds like a reasonable and easy enough thing to do, but if you are in some sort of crisis, if you've got a domestic violence situation, if you've got mental illness, a physical disability, you may miss some of those classes and not be able to get onto cash assistance. One thing that struck me as interesting is even the director of the Department of Social Services there thought it had been an obstacle for some people getting on the rolls, thought it wasn't a good policy, but said his hand had been forced by the new federal rules.
So what's happening here just highlighting and making the obstacles even more difficult in this hard economic environment?
In some places, I think one thing you have to remember about the new welfare system is it's really 51 different welfare systems, if you count the District of Columbia. Florida, which had been very tough in the past years, had an increase of 17 or 18% in its welfare rolls last year. Michigan, on the other hand, with the highest unemployment rate in the country, had a double-digit reduction. So you have 51 different states going in different directions. There are a couple of reasons why you might not expect the welfare rolls to respond immediately to an economic downturn. You know, there could be a lag between the time someone loses their job and goes on cash assistance. They might be able to get other federal help first through, say, an unemployment program. It might be that the recession hit different parts of the economy at different times and is only now beginning to hit the kinds of jobs that poor people take, you know, the kinds of low-skilled jobs. You can't, from this data, make a firm conclusion that needy people are being turned away, but I think it does raise some serious questions about that.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that we can't necessarily look at welfare numbers as an indicator anymore of what's actually going on in the economy. So, like, what would you have us look at?
Well, one interesting contrast is with the food stamp program. Every state last year increased its food stamps, number of people getting food stamps, and overall the number of people nationwide went up 12%. So this at a time when the cash welfare is being kept constant or cut in some states. Food assistance has gone up significantly. One important difference to keep in mind there is the way the two different programs are financed. Food stamps are financed almost entirely by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So every time a state puts another person on food stamps, it's costing the state almost nothing, and it's bringing more money into the state, more federal dollars into the state, more federal dollars that can be spent in local stores, more federal dollars to help local people. By contrast, the welfare system is funded at a fixed level no matter how many people come on the rolls. So that same state that puts someone on food stamps, if they put them on cash assistance, all that money, that entire sum, is coming straight out of the state budget. And I think that does make a difference.
That makes me wonder, what is welfare today? When we think of welfare, there's cash assistance, as you've mentioned. There is vouchers for housing. There are food stamps. Is it consistent across those 51 states?
It's not even consistent within the 51 states. In some places, different counties have different policies, and each of those programs that you discussed has different financing and has different rules. Interestingly, most states don't consider food stamps welfare. So at the same time that we've had public campaigns urging people to get off welfare, by which the states mean cash assistance, don't take cash assistance. We've labeled it a form of dependency. We've said it's bad for families. It erodes the moral work ethic inside the family. At the same time we've done that, we've had public advertisements urging people to get onto food stamps. And we've most states define that not as welfare, but as a form of nutritional assistance. And, of course, you can just as easily buy a hamburger or a banana with the cash aid you're getting as with the food stamps you're getting.
What do you think the latest data that
is a real inconsistent ethos, you know, with the way we approach it. Excuse me, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. What do you think, then, the numbers that you've looked at, what does that tell us about the reforms from 1996?
To take a step back, in 1996, there was an entitlement to federal aid. It was, by current standards very easy to get. The states had limited, much more limited ability to decide who came and who didn't come on the rolls. The rules were made much more difficult in 1996, and many critics thought that lots of poor people would really be damaged by this, would really be hurt. In the years that followed, the rolls fell very sharply, but child poverty rates also fell and employment rates soared. So by and large, for most people, I think the program did help them get off the rolls and into a job in that economy for most people. Now, there was a small group that even then wasn't doing very well, was left with neither welfare nor work. But by and large, you know, most people, it served as a bit of a goad, and they proved more employable than most experts believed. The question hanging over this program has always been, okay, that was in a good economy. What would happen in a bad economy, and what would states do when all this additional assistance had to come directly out of their budgets? And that's what we're seeing right now.
And so let's extrapolate. What do you think we're going to see in the future?
There is a measure in the the economic recovery bills going through Congress that would give states some matching funds if they expanded their assistance to meet the growing need. That may help a little bit at the margin, but again, they're matching funds, so the states have to come up with some money of their own. And I think states are just so strapped for cash, I can't imagine it being much of a priority in many places to put more money into cash welfare when you're competing against schools and all sorts of other pressing needs.
You know,
so I wouldn't foresee a very large expansion.
I want to go back to something you were talking about at the beginning, that, you know, maybe Michigan, if we were looking at that as an example, that maybe there's some sort of lag between when people have lost jobs and they start looking around for some sort of state assistance. But in Michigan, we've had pretty steady unemployment for a while. So what kind of lag would there really have been?
I don't know the month-by-month data on Michigan and whether it came up, you know, whether it rose at the end of the year, but I think in general that's a good point. On the other hand, Georgia, where unemployment has been rising only in the second half of last year, did have a small increase at the end of the year. I don't think that's a major explanation for what's going on, but it could be an explanation in some places.
Jason, is it possible to say that families who need help are getting it or not?
I think it's possible or likely to say that most families are finding it more difficult to get help under this system than they did in the past. And that was true in good times as well. And for some families, that was good in good times because they really could go out and work. And going on to cash assistance had been in the long term a bad thing for them. But we're in a different economy now, and I think we're seeing the downside of some of the gains that we saw earlier.
Jason DeParle, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Jason DeParle is a reporter in the Washington Bureau for the New York Times, and he wrote the book The American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. And today in the New York Times, he has an investigation into whether welfare or how welfare is working in the midst of this economic downturn. And we're thinking about energy efficiency this morning here at The Takeaway because we are launching Power Trip, a series this week, taking a look at some innovative tactics and programs. And what are you doing at home? Do you find it easy or not to save energy, to be more energy efficient, to be more fuel efficient? We want to hear your stories at thetakeaway.org. Our telephone line's a little out of order this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for being with us today, Catherine.
It's always a pleasure, Adora.
John Hockenberry is not on vacation. He's actually working on the West Coast this week, working on a week-long series that we're having here at The Takeaway called Power Trip. We're looking at the future of energy. And we want to know, what's the one thing that you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? Elisa wrote to us on our at thetakeaway.org, and she said, we all need to be inconvenienced and just suck it up. We've lived a life of ultra convenience, and it's put us in this mess. If we all just stopped wasting, we would see a great decrease in our energy use. Well, Catherine, she's right.
What I find funny, though, is I think we all have our different thing that we like to do. And that's what we want to know.
What is the greatest obstacle for you to become more efficient in the way that you use energy or fuel? Can you drop us a line at the takeaway, my takeaway, at thetakeaway.org? We usually have a phone line, but it's being worked on right now.
But we're saving energy.
We are.
All right. Now, Adora, have you ever worked in an office or a newsroom where everyone knew each other's salaries?
Sort of.
Yeah. Well, I did once. Oh, it was not pretty. And who knows what lurks in the pay stub of your cubicle neighbor? More importantly, what would change in your workplace if you did know the salaries of everyone in the office? Christina Cowan is a senior writer for PayScale.com, and she follows, obviously, issues related to pay in the workplace. And she says that she has detected an interesting generational shift when it comes to talking about what is normally that most taboo of subjects, your salary. She joins us from the studios of Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ. All right, Christina, let's just first start off with the fact that there's a lot of salaries that we do know, and I'm thinking about all of those Wall Street bonuses and CEO salaries that got discussed last week, and in fact, that people were even chastised by President Obama.
Right, absolutely. As well they should in view of the American public, because the average American worker hasn't seen his or her salary increase for quite some time. It's actually gone down since 2000. And so when you see Wall Street executives who have sort of presided over this financial meltdown that we're all now paying for through TARP, of course Americans are infuriated. And it's good to have salary transparency all the way up there, because if we didn't, I don't think we'd realize, you know, what's happening with our tax money if, in fact, our tax money has gone to fund the bonuses.
Well, and in fact, you can think of many other salaries that are public, most professional sports players, politicians. So what salaries traditionally are secret?
I think most in this country are secret. Just anecdotally, through my own experience of having worked in offices, I can't think of any one work experience I had where it was okay to talk with your cube mates about how much you made. It certainly was taboo. In the last 2.5 years or so since I've been reporting for PayScale, I've found that sort of taboo is shifting. And I attribute that to the generational shift that's going on in the workplace. You have Generation Y coming up, and it's a very different generation. Their norms are very different from baby boomers, who have dominated the workforce. So you have these two very big groups in terms of their size, and then you have Generation X, which is smaller, but I think is more along the mindset of Generation Y, in that it's okay to have salary transparency.
Well, now, when you say it's generational, does this mean that because someone might post on Facebook every aspect of their personal life, talking about their paycheck is just one more step in that chain?
I think that's certainly part of it. I think the other part of it is just Facebook is generated by technology. Also, sites like PayScale that provide salaries and salary information. Generation Y is always online. So they're going to go online. They're going to find these sites. They're going to find the salary data, take it to their bosses maybe, share it with their friends in social settings, things like that. And we're only going to see more of that. And Generation Y isn't going to let go of technology. So as we proceed in the future, I think we'll see more of that driven by Generation Y wanting the transparency and being equipped with it.
Okay. Transparency, or at the very least, knowing what your neighbor makes, how does that give you a leg up when it comes to negotiating a salary?
I think it depends case by case, individual by individual. If you're comfortable enough with going to your boss and saying, I deserve a raise. The company across the street, a worker with 5 years of experience, which I also have, is making $5,000 more than I do. What can you do to help me? I think it will help the worker who's willing to do that and willing to argue for him or herself. I think for other workers, it will agitate them, maybe make some of them leave.
I was going to say, I can't but help envision the anger of, what? That schmo who all he does is drink coffee? He's making more than I am?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Certainly some people will respond that way. I think it's human nature to, you know, to get angry and to get frustrated. And you never know what goes into someone's job, but you can surmise. And I think it's, you know, surmising is kind of dangerous. You want to be very practical about the information that you gather and try to not lose your cool. And I think the best thing is to be empowered by it and to take your information and gather as much as you can. And hopefully you have a good relationship with your boss and you can go in and discuss with him or her where you are, what your goals are. It's not the only bartering chip you have, but if you're a good performer, it can certainly help make your case.
Okay, quickly, we have to wrap up here, but you used the word empower, and we, of course, are doing a series this week called Power Trip. If you had some way to be more fuel efficient, to be more energy efficient, what would you do? Or is there something that gets in the way of you doing that? What's the one thing you can't live without?
Going to the gym. I'm sure that the machines I use at the gym take up energy. If there was some way to make them, I don't know.
Oh, Christina,
more
get off the elliptical and take a walk. All right. Take care. I want to thank you for joining us. That's Christina Cowan. She's a senior writer for PayScale.com. And let's go to Femi Okeh, who has the latest from the newsroom.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. For a sixth month in a row, consumer spending is down. Americans worried about surging layoffs boosted their savings rate in December to the highest level since May. Consumption spending dropped by 1% in December, and incomes fell for a third straight month. President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden will meet with congressional leaders this afternoon at the White House as the Senate prepares to debate the nearly $900 billion stimulus bill. The president is confident that GOP leaders will approve the plan. First Lady Michelle Obama is heading over to the Department of Education early this afternoon to meet with new Secretary Arne Duncan and his staff. The Obamas have taken a strong interest in the district's troubled school system. In southwestern Pakistan, gunmen have kidnapped an American UN official and killed his driver. John Selecki is the head of the UN Refugee Office on the Afghan border. Let's look at some stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. He's on the West Coast this week working on our series Power Trip, a look at the future of energy. And we're asking you, what are you willing to change to have a more energy-efficient lifestyle? What aren't you? What are obstacles that keep you from changing? Now, Sandy emailed us with this response. We asked her what, you know, her take. Well, she wanted to know what our take is on the population issue in relation to our energy consumption. She also wrote that she and her husband decided not to have any children based on their concern for population growth. Okay, what about you? What are you willing to do or not do to save energy, and what's in your way? Our call line is down right now, but you can email us at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
This month, Iran marks the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The revolution signified a profound political and cultural shift, transitioning its monarchy to an Islamic republic, which was part democracy, part theocracy. Three decades on, it remains one of the most turbulent and important moments in the history of the modern Middle East. Darius Rajali, chair of the Political Science Department of Reed College and author of Torture and Democracy, joins us with his thoughts and perspectives. He comes from Portland, Oregon. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, you were here in the U.S. and your family was in Iran during the revolution. What do you remember?
Well, I remember it was incredibly chaotic. I remember communications broke down between the United States, and I wasn't in touch with my parents for about 6 or 7 months until they appeared in London. And then I remember them actually being here for a while and going back and basically staying there through much of the dark period that followed the revolution, particularly the war, all the way up until 94. So it was a long and difficult period. Anyone who's seen the movie Persepolis knows that it was kind of a difficult period for a lot of people, both here and there.
Marking this anniversary or celebrating the anniversary in the case of some, does it really drudge up seemingly internal conflict the country has seemed to feel about the revolution?
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, it's a lot like Cuba in some ways. Certainly here, it brings up a lot of bad memories for people, that's for sure. I mean, a lot of people kind of, when they look back at the Islamic Republic, they kind of think, when is it going to go away? And they kind of have two models of it. You know, one is that a model that says it's like the Soviet Union or Poland. One day it's a totalitarian country and it just won't last. And some other people kind of think of it like an authoritarian state like South America, Chile. Usually that's people on the right or people on the left have these views. I think for me, the really sort of deeper problem is that the better analogy, actually, in a way, is that it's like the American South in the 1950s, particularly in Mississippi, where you have a deeply divided society, deeply divided about its values. You got some people who are religious but who are for civil rights, and you got other people who control the press and the judiciary and can count on their supporters to show up and beat up the people who want civil rights. And, sometimes this is viewed as a conflict between young and old Iranians, but what's really important is that it's the society itself, and it's still trying to figure out what it is.
But when you say it's society itself, doesn't the generational gap, isn't that significant? Because many of those involved in the revolution are older now, and there seems to be a newer generation which doesn't necessarily seem as inclined to support what they stood for.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think it's certainly true that there's an enormous population growth that's happened, since I left there were 35 million, and now it's close to 70 million people. So half the country's pretty young and born after the revolution. But the other thing to recognize is a lot of the news that we get out of Tehran, out of Iran, it really comes from Tehran, and it's from reporters who see the young people in Tehran. You know, about 6 or 7 years ago, I went back to Iran to look at what was happening in the provinces and how elections were going down the provinces. And there I would find young people who were equally adamantly for the revolution on the other side.
And so do you think that explains how President Ahmadinejad got elected and he is up for re-election this year?
Well, first of all, yeah, I think, Ahmadinejad was a complete surprise. Nobody thought that he would come in from the rear. He got a tremendous amount of votes from the veterans of the war. And it's really important to recognize this because there were two kinds of veterans who came back from the war, those who believed in justice and the ideals of the revolution and fought for equality. And those guys all became reformists. And then there were those who went out of loyalty and piety and faith, and those guys became the people who voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad. So I think, it represents a deep conflict even in the older generation, and the younger generation who has parents in these areas also feel these tensions. Anyway, as far as, there is definitely an election coming up. We can't predict. These are often very unpredictable events. No one, as I say, knew Ahmadinejad. What I can confirm for you, Catherine, is that I can't, I am not running for office this year. It is a big problem, and I will not run for office.
Come on.
I'm a good talker, and my cousins all think I should, but you know, the facts are that the Islamic Republic has some major problems going in. It's a very paradoxical state. I mean, it's got like, well, first of all, it's got a major economic problem. It's got major environmental pollution problems, and the price of oil has collapsed, which has seriously affected the economy. Plus, we have the new Afghan surge coming up. So if you were president of Iran, you'd have a lot of problems. Kind of like my academic job.
Kind of like your academic job. Well, thank you for your thoughts on the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Darius Rajali, professor of political science at Reed College and chair of Reed's political science department. He's also the author of Torture and Democracy. Femi Okeh now has headlines for us.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, more than 100 people have been arrested in Pittsburgh as celebrations spilled into the streets after the Super Bowl last night. Several fires were set and hundreds of emergency calls made. Things were more subdued in Arizona, where Cardinal fans admit it hurts after coming so close to their first ever Super Bowl win. The Steelers won 27-23. Eric Holder's confirmation as Attorney General is almost a lock today. Even most Republicans are expected to vote for him when the full Senate takes it up for a vote. Meanwhile, former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle has written a letter to Senate leaders saying that he's deeply embarrassed by revelations that he's failed to pay more than $100,000 in taxes he owed for the use of a private car and driver after he left the Senate. And Daschle is expected to meet with leaders of the Senate Finance Committee tonight. And the global economic crisis has resulted today in being an historic one for the gay and lesbian movement. Iceland has announced a new government that will be headed by the modern world's first openly gay leader, and that would be Prime Minister Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir. Now, Prime Minister Dóttir is Icelandic's first female prime minister and is widely liked, and the popular politician is often called Saint Jóhanna. And the Icelandic public.
That's tough, calling you a saint. You got something to live up to.
No kidding.
The Icelandic public are hoping that she'll be able to turn around bankrupt Iceland's fortunes. That's a look at the news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. The Senate, of course, takes on the stimulus package this week. One way to measure its impact? Look west. Look toward California. A projected budget deficit there is like something like $42 billion. It's larger than the total expenditures in nearly 40 states, Adora. One estimate puts California's take from the proposed stimulus package at more than $32 billion. New York Times reporter Jesse McKinley is going to join us now from San Francisco to talk about what happens when we do look and take apart the stimulus package and what it means for California. Hey, Jesse.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, why would California be a better measure than, say, we've been talking a lot this morning about Michigan, a state like Michigan?
Well, there's the question of size, first of all. I mean, obviously, as the nation's most populous state, there's a lot of people to be served in this state. But then, in addition, if you kind of look at the parameters of the infrastructure project, you know, there's an infrastructure element, there's a green tech element, there's a high-tech element, there's a rural broadband element. A lot of these things are kind of fairly noticeably recognized here in California. So you've got a lot of different moving pieces that will have an effect here.
Yeah, well, given all those moving pieces, though, where is most of the money actually going to go?
Well, the infrastructure project will have kind of the most immediate impact kind of on the ground. Already all over California, the counties have come forward with this kind of grandiose wish list of things that they'd love to have done, you know, everything from rebuilding roads in little tiny towns in Southern California to kind of grand landfill projects in San Diego to, you know, building broadband in Del Norte County, which is at the very top of the state where, as near as I can tell, trees outnumber people.
And they should paint your house, right?
That would be terrific as well. And child care, you know, that would be great.
Okay, but so what I'm wondering, though, if there's a part of the state that you think is going to get more money than another part. I mean, it isn't going to be applied equally.
No, and certainly depending on what the Senate does, this could all change radically during the course of the week. I think that obviously the bigger urban areas will have their hand out. In reporting this story last week, a lot of the kind of more lightly populated areas were already grousing that they were only going to get kind of a pittance out of this giant pie. So places like Los Angeles County will obviously have a lot of impact, San Diego County. Up here in the north in the Bay Area, a lot of the transit agencies are looking for kind of big handouts.
And in terms of looking at California as a litmus test or some sort of indicator, talk about the limitations of this stimulus package for any state, but especially for California.
Well, in the case of California, California has enormous financial problems. As you mentioned before, you know, it's a $42 billion deficit here. They've got kind of a paralysis in the state house, and not to mention a drought coming on, which is probably going to take a big cut out of their agricultural output for the year. So the state itself has a huge hole to fill, and even if they were to get the maximum amount of federal monies, even if they were able to somehow weasel more money out of the Senate, it's not going to address all the problems that the state already has.
All right, Jesse, we're going to leave it there for now, but thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Jesse McKinley is a reporter with one of our partners, the New York Times, and he has a report out today about what it's like to look at California as an indicator or a litmus test for the stimulus package. Adora?
You have to wonder what the ultimate number, the deficit, is going to be. They started at somewhere around $10 billion, and as you've just reported, it's now closer to $42
billion. Yeah, we're talking real money.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 2nd, and Femi Okeh has some headlines for us.
Hello, I certainly do. The time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. We've had some fresh economic data this morning, and it's more bad news. Consumer spending dropped for a record sixth straight month. Numbers were even lower than forecasters feared. Personal income also sank and dragged down by a wave of layoffs. President Obama hopes his economic stimulus package can turn those numbers around, but first it needs to pass the Senate. Senators debate it this week. The president wants Republicans to vote for it. Both he and Democratic Senate leaders are signalling that they could make some changes to gain GOP support. President Obama is poised to tap New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg as Commerce Secretary. His state's Democratic governor apparently won't name a Democrat to fill Gregg's Senate seat, though. The top Senate Republican says that Gregg assures him that if he takes the cabinet post, his Senate replacement will vote with Republicans.
I think there's going to be more to that story. That's my prediction.
The GOP wants the balance of power to stay the same. Any more comments, Adora?
Nope.
Okie dokie. And that's where we'll leave your news for now. How would Adora put it?
Thanks very much, Femi. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry, who is on the West Coast. He is working on our week-long series, Power Trip. He's looking at innovations in the future of energy. We want to know, what's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy, and what obstacles are in your way? Ken in Brooklyn writes he would love to ride his bike to work, but the building he works in refuses to add bike racks. Shame on them, really. Tell us what you can't give up or what stands in your way. You can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Our call line is temporarily down, but is being fixed as we speak. Catherine.
All right. Now, Adora, some of us keep score at the Super Bowl this way.
The Pittsburgh Steelers become the first franchise in history to win six Super Bowls.
And some of us keep score this way.
Like that drinkability, huh? Drinkability means Bud Light's easy to drink. See, Bud Light goes down smooth like this guy here.
That's right. For some of us, the big game is about, well, the drinkability of beer, the right website to help you find a job, any 30-second story or pitch that's going to make you laugh, or not. To help us look at the cultural and economic indicators in all those spots last night, we turned to behavioral economist Dan Ariely. He's a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University and the author of Predictably Irrational, and he joins us from Durham, North Carolina. All right, consumer confidence is at a 30-year low, and we still had a record-setting $200 million spent on these ads. What gives?
Well, I think we have an attentional economy as far as advertisements are concerned. You know, everybody is fighting on the same attention of the same people. And what is happening is that this price for this attention is too high. And to think about it, imagine the following. Imagine there were two lotteries. One week there was a lottery with a big price was $400 million, and one week it was only $20. Which one would you join?
Both. These are tough times,
yeah,
man.
There we go.
Well, first of all, the fact that these are tough times means you should not join the lottery because the expected value is negative. But let's say that you're going to use one. Most people say, I'll go for the big one because the price is bigger. Well, mm-hmm. because the price is bigger, more people join, and actually the expected value is even lower. The same thing happens in the Super Bowl. Too many people want to advertise on the Super Bowl, and because too many people want to join the party, the value of the party is lower. The actual amount of effort that they're paying for, the amount of attention, is way, way too low.
So why did the companies do it?
Well, part of the problem is that there's a lot of hype around the Super Bowl. We all have these images of these very famous ad, 1984 and so on, that really made a big difference. And everybody hoped that they will do it. The second thing is that advertising is actually very hard to evaluate. If you think about it, companies do a lot of things in the domain of advertising. And it's very hard to actually figure out what's the effect of every particular ad. So they basically go on gut intuition and feel that this is the right thing to do.
All right, you're a behavioral. Now, Go ahead.
At the same time that this is depressing, I want to say that there's a few good things about the ads last night. And the one that you started playing, the drinkability, I think was a very clever move. I mean, if you think about it, beer is a very ambiguous experience. You know, we're drinking this bitter stuff. We're not even supposed naturally to like bitter stuff. We're supposed to be repulsed by it. But nevertheless, we convince ourselves over the years that bitter is good and we like beer. And it's inherently an ambiguous experience. Now, what Budweiser did was to say there's another dimension to beer called drinkability. What is it? I have no idea. How do you evaluate it? I don't know. But they say it's an important dimension and we are the best on it. Well, and that's kind of a clever move.
Okay, so as a behavioral economist, what other ads did you see last night where they won the lottery, so to speak?
I thought that the Hulu.com ad was quite good.
Oh, with Alec Baldwin as an alien?
Yes.
In fact, let's go ahead and let's listen to that.
Hello, Earth. I'm Alec Baldwin, TV star. You know, they say TV will rot your brain. That's absurd. TV only softens the brain like a ripe banana. To take it all the way, we've created Hulu. Hulu beams TV directly to your portable computing devices, giving you more of the cerebral gelatinizing shows you want anytime, anywhere, for free.
God, I love that ad. All right.
So I think not only was he good at it, but on top of that, it basically kind of used reverse psychology. It said everybody's saying television is bad for you. People feel guilty about it. We're going to take it to the extreme and tell you it's really much, much worse for you than you think. We're going to make fun of it. And Hulu is the extreme version of this mind-numbing activity.
All right. I think we're going to let you go now, but I want to thank you so much for joining us, Dan.
My pleasure, anytime.
Dan Ariely, he is a professor of behavioral economics, helping us out with a quick review of the ads on the Super Bowl last night.
And I think we actually have my co-host on the line. John Hockenberry, are you there?
I'm so jealous. You're talking to Dan.
I know. He's the best.
He is the best.
But you're on a mission, John. Tell us about it.
I'm on a power trip, as usual, right? You know? So it's this week, we are taking a look at energy and the energy future in the United States, and we're going to all kinds of places and looking at it. You know, I've discovered right off the bat, if you're looking for, like, fabulous gadgets that do wild and fantastic things, forget it.
It's not
Forget
there.
Forget it. What do you mean?
No, the energy in your house comes from what? The most boring thing there is, right? The furnace. What I'm looking at this week are boring boxes that change things and make energy more efficient, but you can't really see how it's done. So we've got to make this interesting, and that's our challenge.
Now, where are you today, and what are you going to be looking
right
into?
Now, right. I'm in Seattle right now. We're going to go to a place that uses algae to produce biofuel. That's really fascinating, huh?
Oh, sure it is.
I've watched a lot of paint dry, okay? So I think I'm down for this.
No, the other thing it sounds way more interesting than paint drying. I can't wait to hear how you
energy.
Start with little fuzzy things and you end up with energy.
Well, you have to kill them in the process.
Ah!
No, but it's actually a great new frontier of developing biofuel. The other thing we're doing today is, you know, the biggest energy-sucking device in most people's houses is the air conditioner. And there's a fascinating new way of air conditioning that actually mimics the way human beings regulate their own temperature.
Ooh, you got me really curious about that.
Yeah.
And I would assume it's very inexpensive, right?
Well, you know, it's inexpensive over the long haul, like a lot of these things, but the upfront investment is formidable, and that's what a lot of these companies are running into problems with.
All right. Well, you're going to be a busy bee all week bringing us all kinds of programs, right? You're talking to scientists and innovators and academics and so on?
Yeah, we'll eventually make our way down to Southern California, where we are talking to venture capitalists, who are the people who actually pull the trigger to decide if some of these investments are actually going to be made.
And it'll be interesting to hear if they actually have any money these days.
Yeah, there's a whole group who were invested with Madoff, but they'll be crying quietly in the corner. I don't think we'll talk to them.
Oh, not them. John Hockenberry will be looking forward to your reports. Hockenberry comes to us from Seattle as a part of our Power Trip series on The Takeaway this week. We're going to be looking at energy efficiency and all kinds of innovative programs that are happening on the West Coast. John's got them. We're asking you today, what's the one thing you can't give up or won't give up to save energy? And what obstacles are in place that you believe keep you from changing? And we've been getting your emails. Eric writes, during hard times, there's a big incentive to buy used products rather than new ones. The used products are often older and less efficient. Mm. That's an interesting point. Another listener writes, Catherine.
I am willing to do nothing to save energy until other people stop having so many children. I can live in a cold, dark place and eat only grass. It won't matter as long as the world population keeps growing.
And some of you have changed your mind about what steps we need to take. One New Yorker writes us to say he used to think cars should not be allowed in Central Park, but not anymore. He says now the current system of restrictions works just fine. Cars are necessary for getting around town, and half the time if you're twice as old. We want to hear your thoughts. Tell us about the obstacles or ways that you're becoming more efficient, and you can do that at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Catherine Lanfer, who's been in for John Hockenberry as he's on his mission on the West Coast, thank you.
Oh, always a pleasure to be here, Adora.
I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway, and we'll have reports from John Hockenberry from Seattle tomorrow.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.